Lecture 11, Roman, Canon, and Natural Law.
In the last lecture, we were noticing that Augustine has a tremendous appreciation for the Roman Republic, and that it gave him a strong sense of what the possibilities of nature, what the possibilities of natural law were. Even though he himself is inclined to attribute more to grace when dealing with how one becomes moral and how one becomes virtuous, his own appreciation for what Rome had done was unabashed. A part of that appreciation comes from what Roman law had achieved. I'd like, in the course of this lecture, to spend some time with that movement in Roman law that was already in full blossom by the time of Augustine, the work of Roman jurists in the preceding centuries. Even though Roman law was very pragmatic and not terribly philosophical, its great jurists were often philosophers and were highly indebted to the Stoics. Roman law, as they practiced it and as they wrote about it, does provide an enormous contribution to the subsequent history of natural law. Our topic then today will be to focus on law, and particularly civil law, as it tries to embody various concepts of natural law. For the sake of our lecture today, I'll divide the work into three parts. First, a consideration of the Roman law, such as a person like Augustine knew it, as already developed. Secondly, to Roman law as it gets codified by Justinian in the century after Augustine. And then I'd like to move ahead to the development of canon law that takes place in the High Middle Ages, especially in the 11th century with the monk Gratian, who does a tremendous work of bringing together the church's emerging law. Frequently, it's the case in civil law that the body of law has to come together over the years and after there has been much jurisprudence, and that's certainly the case with both Roman law and canon law, and we'll have a chance to look at some of that. So those will be the three parts of today's lecture. First, then, the subject of Roman law. Roman law was a body of law in the sense that there are many pieces of legislation that emerged from various Roman authorities, and then there are an enormous set of precedents as Roman jurists were required to decide various cases. And in the course of their various decisions, the accumulation of precedents form part of law. There's a much stronger unity, you might say, to the composition of law than we ourselves experience. I think in our situation, we're inclined to say that only legislatures have the right and the privilege to make law, and that the judiciary is charged with ensuring the conformity of law to our existing constitution, but that in general, at least, the courts ought not to be making law. With Rome, that was not the case. There was not such a strong and strict division there, and so one finds a fair amount of judicial legislation in the course of trying to answer problems about which the civil law had not yet spoken. It is in this department especially, as well as in the efforts to try to give a reason why particular cases need to be decided the way they are under existing law, that Roman jurists use the concept of natural law. They rely upon the Stoics, especially because the Stoics were extremely eclectic in their philosophizing, taking a little bit here and a little bit there. The Stoics were not such rigid purists about the sources of law, the sources of philosophy. They were rather insistent upon taking wisdom where they could find it and cultivating the idea of the sage, who had good sense about some particular topic. I think the Roman lawyers appreciated that, and they were equally eclectic, often borrowing from the Stoics. And the concept that they borrow from the Stoics especially is the notion of a real universal equality among all human beings. But the Roman jurists also are extremely acquainted with Aristotle's teaching on ethics, courtesy of Cicero. That after the time of Cicero, Roman jurists become more and more philosophical. Figures like Gaius and Paulus and Ulpian and Marianus. These Roman jurists take a lot of what Cicero had to say and expand yet further upon it. But the other philosophical source to which they are particularly indebted is Aristotle's theory of justice. We covered most of that a few lectures ago, but I'd like to focus for just a minute on one part of his theory of justice from the Nicomachean Ethics, which the Roman jurists found especially useful. It's the concept of equity, equitas is said in Latin, and the Roman jurists found enormous use of this concept from Aristotle. It's that part of justice which comes at the end of his treatment of justice in Book 5, when Aristotle is considering the fact that legislatures, when they make law, have to make law for everybody under all possible circumstances, and that legislatures can't possibly envision all the circumstances that might come up on which their law will be dependent for rendering good decisions. And hence Aristotle offers the notion that there must be, on the part of judges, a certain commitment to equity, a certain commitment to equality, and that this commitment to equality will mean figuring out what the legislator would have said if the legislator could have envisioned this particular circumstance. It's a sense that the way in which laws are written might sometimes produce great injustices, not because the laws were badly designed, not because the legislatures were self-interested or committed simply to the interests of their own party, but simply because law has to be general and new circumstances will come up. The Roman jurists loved that concept in Aristotle, and they use it frequently. In sum, then, what I find in the studies of Roman law is that Roman jurists were willing to make a commitment to natural law, and they were willing to defend it in so many words. It seemed to them to have the real splendor that truth has when they think they've figured out something. Secondly, it offered what the Stoics had most proposed, namely a sense of conformity with nature, that there would be a harmony if this natural law principle is used. And thirdly, and this is very distinctive of Roman law and is not true at all of Greek law, it gave them a way to transcend various cultures and societies. Greek law was always city law. In fact, the Greeks in the ancient period never coalesced as one nation or as one state, but rather they were always individual states, and they much cherished and valued and defended their individual laws. But as Rome came to have an empire, there was a need to look beyond the boundaries of just the city of Rome or just those cities in Italy united with Rome, but to look to Greece and to Egypt and to the Near East, as far west as Spain, north into Gaul and Germany. And what the Roman genius in law included was a sense of the need to preserve local institutions and local customs as far as possible with regard to the law, that they were willing to tolerate any number of legal customs that were highly unique to one particular culture or others. What the natural law gave the Romans was a way to say, we can look for what is common, what is the identical element, or at least a very similar element, in these many law codes. This is a concept which has the formal name of jus gentium, translated the law or the right of nations. It's a concept which Cicero articulated in his De Officiis, which we studied together, and which the Roman jurists, Ulpian and Gaius and Paulus, loved to comment on precisely because it was a way in which to see in these great varieties of legal customs that the Romans encountered in the process of forming their empire, a native, healthy respect for the standard of natural justice. Whatever the other trappings of law in any one of these particular cultures or societies, fine, let them have their own particular diversity. But insofar as their law respects life and respects property and has other instances of natural justice, for the Roman jurist, this is a sign that there has to be a kind of a natural law behind any given civil code. They called it the jus gentium and make tremendous use of it. Now, among Roman jurists, there still is disagreement with regard to the natural law, and I think it would be useful for us to spend a few minutes on that subject. There's an extremely important 3rd century figure by the name of Ulpian. He is very clear about saying that natural law, this standard of complete and objective justice, is partially, but only partially, recorded in jus gentium. He is much more inclined to say that what natural law means is the law that is within any given animal species, whether it be humans as animals, whether it be the laws of the lions or the laws of the bears, not a moral law in those cases, but a way in which they operate, and he associates natural law with the way our bodily instincts, the way in which our biological organism is structured. He is willing to hold that there is a jusgentium, but he's a little bit more of the positivist, a little bit more inclined to say that jusgentium is a matter of human construction. In this respect, Ulpian is taking one theme in natural law, namely the notion that the natural law, if it's natural, will have to be biologically embedded. His fellow jurists, however, will disagree with him. The jurist I have in mind in particular is the man named Gaius, who stressed that the natural law and the jusgentium were one and the same, a very strong sense that what it is that a lawyer needs to know about natural law can, in fact, be culled from this survey of other legal institutions. And this common element of justice that is found in the law codes of these many cultures will, in fact, show you what the natural law is. When these jurists, Ulpian and Gaius, are reading their Cicero and are trying to reflect the natural law at the beginning of their own comments on the body of Roman law as it grew up with legislation and with precedent, they are quick to point out where some of the main areas that natural law touches civil law will be found. They quickly find it in areas of kinship relations, so questions of marriage and family, which they see in all the various cultures which their law codes have to concern. Likewise, they find it in an area like contracts, namely that contracts don't have to be made, they're voluntary associations, but that if they are made, they need to be made in good faith, and that that's a natural law requirement of a contract. Likewise, they have a sense that promises must be kept. They have a sense that when contracts are violated and these matters come to the courts, what the jurist has to do is really to weigh the advantages and the disadvantages that were present in the initial contract. Frequently enough, the violations of contract come when one party has fulfilled the obligations that were undertaken, but now feel that the recompense is inadequate. Situations have changed. Or perhaps I should say that situation is still the same. That's still the origin of much contract dispute in our own time. But the natural law jurists, among them Ulpian and Gaius, found that there are natural law obligations which they need to respect. Likewise, they have a strong sense that you can't and you shouldn't be bound simply by the literal terms of the contract if the terms are badly phrased, and that one needs to understand the intention of those contracting. In all of these respects, they have a strong sense of the way in which natural law has a great impact on the civil law, and they try to record it. One finds these debates, of course, continuing into our own time, and I couldn't help but think of the questions now that circulate about same-sex marriages that are being debated in the halls of our legislators. I think those debates would probably profit much by asking the question a little bit more deeply whether there is such a thing as a nature or a natural standard to marriage. I think that that would aid at least the debate as it needs to go forward, because at least some of the parties are urging that the kind of association, the kind of contract, the kind of union that is involved in marriage is simply something of human production, simply something of human institution, and hence can be altered at human whim. And this is a way in which I think a good understanding of the natural law might aid that debate. Roman jurists also were extremely inclined to make a distinction between two terms which are useful for our knowledge of the natural law, the term jus and the term lex, lex as in legislation, jus as in jurist or jurisprudence. Generally, by the term jus, what they mean is a whole system of law and a system of right, so Roman law or Athenian law, we might say American law. By lex, they are inclined to think of the particular legislation that is coming down the pike, so a law about taxes or a law about the military or a law about property. And it's this strong sense that they have that the various cultures that they are meeting and trying to deal with, each of them has a jus of its own, a body of law, and their interest is in seeing whether this body of law that the Greeks have and that the Egyptians have and that the Romans have and any other culture which they meet, whether this jus that any one of the nations has can generate for them a common jus, that is, a natural law which will be common to all of them. And so they are willing to undertake that very notion of a law of nations as being part of the natural law. To them, it struck them, I think, as though there were a happy coincidence between the very strongly inductive maneuver in which you're comparing various law codes to try to see what is common, or whether you're operating philosophically and thinking about the natural end-directedness of our nature and of our being and of our biological structure, and then metaphysically inferring what the obligations that are part of morality are that must come from this. Now, this code, this body of law that the Romans had articulated, does eventually break down with the fall of Rome. But as emperors squabble and there is tremendous civil strife in the period of the empire after the fall of Rome, eventually there is a reunification, and Justinian is to be credited with the political reunification of Rome and with the recovery of Roman law. He makes, in the year 533, a codification of law with the aid of many legal scholars who are in his service. And as such, right at the very beginning of his digest, which is the beginning of the book, The Corpus of Civil Law, that is written, there is an appreciation for natural law as being the first and supreme and an utterly telling moral norm that must be set before the legislator. Now, let me point out the significance of the way in which he stated that. He is not allowing natural law for the purpose of judicial review. He's not suggesting that natural law will give jurists a license to go correcting law. Rather, he is insisting at the book, the very beginning of the book in which he codifies Roman law, he's suggesting that natural law ought to inspire the legislator. In short, it ought to be a reason why, in politics, people think of the natural standard of justice, why people think in terms of what is right, and argue about it because it is not infallibly or intuitively clear what is right, and one needs to argue, admittedly, using this moral standard. But he would urge that that moral standard, natural law, be the source for legislators. Jurists, on the other hand, in the understanding of Justinian, have to be extremely faithful to what the law formally says. In short, he's a very strict constructionist and implies that all jurists have to be simply faithful to the law as lawmakers make it, but that lawmakers ought to be subject to the natural law. One sees on that very first page of the digest no less than three, I think, incompatible understandings of what natural law is. Let me read the text or two here and then discuss them. But what I'm driving at in looking at these texts is the ways in which natural law had, by this point in history, 533, come to be understood, and Justinian and his legal team, being entirely faithful to the historical record, are mindful of the fact that there are plural ways of understanding natural law. One understanding is the understanding of Ulpian, namely, natural law is that which all animals have been taught by nature. This law, says Ulpian, is not peculiar to the human species. It is common to all animals which are produced on land or sea, and to fowls of the air as well. From it comes the union of man and woman called by us matrimony, and therewith the procreation and rearing of children. We find, in fact, that animals in general, the very wild beasts, are marked by acquaintance with this law. I don't think his point is that all animals have to be moral in the way we do, but rather that there's a biological basis for morality in us, just as there's a biological basis for very regulated activity in animals. That was the Ulpian sense of the basis of natural law. Secondly, he cites the jurist Gaius, and Gaius is of that Jus Gentium tradition, as I pointed out. He says, all nations which are governed by statutes and customs make use partly of law which is peculiar to the respective nations, and partly of such as is common to all mankind. Whatever law any nation has established for itself is peculiar to the particular state and is called civil law, as being the peculiar law of that state. But law which natural reason has laid down for mankind in general is maintained equally by all men, and is called jus gentium, as being the law which all nations use. What I take from that text is that the Roman jurist Gaius is being quoted by Justinian to say natural law is the jus gentium, and the jus gentium, or international law, law of nations, is the common element in all these law codes which makes any of them reasonable. Third, he cites the jurist Paulus, and here I think one has a sense of whether a given law code has it or not, reason requires that there be natural justice. Let's listen to Paulus. The word jus, he says, is used in a number of different senses. In the first place, in that in which the name is applied to that which is under all circumstances fair and right, as in the case of natural law. Secondly, where the word jus signifies that which is available for the benefits of all or most persons in any particular state, as in the case of the expression civil law. And there you have a sense of whether a given civil law incorporates the right or not. Reason can discover what natural justice is. In short, then, Justinian's work is not necessarily to sort out all of these discrepancies in a way that a philosopher would, but rather to reconcile them in a way that a jurist wants to. Namely, let's use all three, and we'll use one now, and use another at a second time, and use the third where it proves pragmatic. And this is the very pragmatic, very highly differentiated sense of the jurist, that what we need to do is to solve problems. We don't necessarily need philosophical consistency. We'll find later on as we go, in particular Thomas Aquinas in the next lecture, a concern for trying to actually integrate and not merely juxtapose these three understandings. For the remainder of our time in this lecture, though, I'd like to turn to a third group of lawyers, this time church lawyers, sometimes called canon lawyers, lawyers who are dealing with ecclesiastical law. Law within the church, as it emerged in the Christian period, was very much an organic growth, namely the church as it was found in Rome, the church as it was found in Gaul, the church as it was found in Spain, the church as it was found in various countries of the East. And each of them developed various laws for the sake of the problems which there emerged. As there came to be a certain emphasis upon referring cases to the see at Rome, that is to the popes, there was an effort to standardize this, but I don't think that it resulted in a complete standardization until the 11th century, at which point the popes commissioned a monk by the name of Gratian, who was teaching law at the newly founded university in Bologna. And in the course of his investigations, he came to publish a book called The Harmony of Discordant Canons around the year 1139. Very much in the fashion of Justinian for Roman law, Gratian tried to do for ecclesiastical law the same basic reconciliation. He, too, found it necessary to consider the topic of natural law, and does so very near the beginning of his volume. He adds a fourth source of natural law. So besides the notion of natural law as equivalent to the animal nature that we have, secondly, natural law as equivalent to the jus gentium, or common element of various law codes, thirdly, natural law as what reason requires, reflecting on nature, just Gratian adds a fourth, namely, natural law is virtually equivalent to divine law. His sense is that the law that is given in the scriptures, what we were talking about when we examined Exodus and Deuteronomy, the law that is given in the scriptures is natural law because it is the law that God intended for the governance of human nature. This, too, will prove problematic to the philosophers, and we will see in the next lecture, indeed we saw it a few lectures ago when we were considering the four kinds of law that Thomas Aquinas distinguishes and organizes into a hierarchy. Aquinas will try to say there's an overlap between divine law and natural law, but that they're different kinds of law, the one being explicit and revealed, the other being reason reflecting on our nature. Gratian is very inclined simply to coalesce them and to state that they're virtually equal, and this will be true of much of the tradition of canon law, to take natural law and divine law to be virtually equivalent. Gratian does begin the distinction, though, namely that some of the things that are mentioned in Leviticus, some of the things that are mentioned in Deuteronomy, are truly ceremonial law and are no longer required to be observed. And so he has got the beginnings of the distinction, which Thomas will continue to exploit. In the very first part of his book, it's the section is called the Decretum, and it's a sense of the various decrees that have been given and that need to be made clear. Gratian cites a figure by the name of Isidore of Seville, who had lived just shortly after Justinian's time, and he starts to talk about natural law in Isidore's words. Let me quote a moment. He talks about the natural law as requiring the possession of all things in common and requiring one freedom for all. Now, those two points are things that are not usually stated in Roman law, but these are rather Isidore reflecting the whole patristic tradition that is a reflection upon Genesis, under the Christian dispensation, that is the Christian interpretation of those Old Testament scriptures. And they will be sources of great insight, but also sources of great philosophical perplexity. Let me comment on both of those things in turn. First, he's saying that the natural law requires the possession of all things in common. Now this is, if it's taken entirely and literally, is an attack on private property, right? It's a suggestion that at the time of the Garden of Eden, God gave the whole world to Adam and suggested that everything in this physical world is designed for Adam and for his progeny. And what Isidore, and here Gratian picking up on Isidore, is suggesting is that this remains true, namely that the whole world is basically given for all of us. Where do things become private? How is it that private property emerges? And this will be a source of enormous philosophical intrigue as we move on, because by this time, by I think early times in history, private property is already something that people cherish. We'll especially see when we get to John Locke how important it is to try to identify what the source of the privacy involved in private property is. Gratian is here largely suggesting something that will be very true for the whole Christian tradition, namely that property is primarily, that physical goods are primarily for everyone's use. If they are taken for private property, mine or yours, that's perfectly fine, especially if there's an abundance. But in a situation of great emergency, if we have someone who desperately needs to feed their children and cannot find any other recourse and has tried everything, may that person take what does not belong to that person because there is tremendous need. The scholastic figures who follow Gratian will be happy to assert that they may indeed, in the time of dire need, they may indeed take such physical goods because they are primarily common and only secondarily private. But that's to get ahead of our story. Right here, we simply have Gratian taking his lead from Isidore and asserting something which will be the source of thinking as we go along. Secondly, there is the assertion that Gratian is quoting from Isidore that the natural law requires one freedom for all. Here, too, it's a matter of thinking about freedom and slavery. And Gratian goes on to explain that, like private property, slavery, too, was introduced into the world not as a good thing, but as a result of sin. And that Christian category of sin coming into play, it's a suggestion that there really is something deeply wrong with slavery. It's the very sign of a fallen world. It will take a long time before this is fully fleshed and people will now start to do anything about slavery, but a strong sense that each individual human being, because of human nature, because of being a creature of God, because of being a child of God, will rightly have a freedom that belongs to each individual, and hence that there's something deeply wrong with the institution of slavery. What Gratian adds to the patristic heritage, something that he doesn't find simply in his patristic sources, is a sense of using natural law for purposes of judicial review. And this, too, will be an increasingly prominent part of our lecture series as we move to the end of it, namely, whether you may use this standard of natural justice, this standard of right, however it is obtained, whether it is obtained by reflecting on biological nature, whether it's obtained by reflecting upon the common element in diverse law codes, whether it's obtained by reason reflecting on what is fair and equal, or our common reflection upon what the scriptural law holds from Exodus, Deuteronomy, and various points of the gospel. The question is not so much where is it coming from, but how strongly may we use it? And we see, for instance, at Decretum number 8 by Gratian, the following quotation. Anything which is against natural law is null and void. Now, that's a very, very strong sense. This is not just a direction to legislators about how they ought to proceed in making law, but it's a directive which can and will be used by jurists for overturning existing law codes. As one follows out the history of ecclesial law, of canon law, they did not until the 16th century, until there was a whole new kind of slavery that came in with the discovery of the Americas and that the subject of slavery again returned to ecclesiastical courts. They did not until the 16th century use it to overturn laws about slavery. but rather they did use this at any number of points to overturn local laws and local customs. For instance, pertaining to divorce legislation that had been introduced in certain parts of Europe, and the strong suggestion of the canonists is that there's something indissoluble about all marriage, and hence they would use a phrase such as anything which is against the natural law is null and void to overturn local laws in some of those marriage institutions. On this subject, let me close by just recommending an excellent book. It's written by Harold Berman, and it's called Law and Revolution. It's a wonderful study of how these canon lawyers took up both the natural law tradition and the Roman law tradition to create the institution of canon law and to change the social footing in which the church found itself. Absolutely brilliant book, and I'd like to commend it to you.